beginning of Vayishlach, of course, deals with the message sent by Yaakov to Esav as a prelude to their meeting, which Yaakov judges to be inevitable, and looking for a positive outcome. And it sends a conciliatory message, Va'eshlecha lahagid laduni limtzochein be'einecha. I'm looking to make the peace. So the Malachim come back, and as we've noted in the past, according to Rashi, they are Malachim Mamish, actual angels, in order to ensure that they will come back in one piece. And they do. Vayeshuva ha-Malachim el Yaakov lemor, Pasuk Zion. They say, Bonu elochicha el Esav. We came to Esav. Vegam olech likrosecha v'abamios ishimo. And he's coming to meet you with 400 men. Now Rashi comments on the words El Achicha El Esav. They're easy to translate to your brother, to Esav. And Rashi says, of course, as much as we know what they mean, but we also know who Esav is. The Pasuk could have said, Banu El Esav. Esav is Yaakov's brother. That much we should have remembered. So to emphasize, Banu el Achicha el Esav, the word your brothers seems to be somewhat redundant. And thus Rashi comments, Banu el Achicha el Esav, Shehayisa Omer Achihu. You said, he's my brother. Meaning, you thought he's your brother. You hoped he's your brother. You hoped he would relate to you as a brother. Aval hu noeg imcha ke Esav harasha. But really, he's Esav. Odenu bisyonaso. He's still consumed with hatred. So this comment of Rashi, I believe, is a great chiddush. There is no question that he is reacting to the seeming redundancy of the phrase El Achicha, El Esav. But his reaction is to explain that the words Achicha represent the situation as Yaakov hoped it would be, and El Esav represent the situation as it is. That's quite a chiddush, I think, in Parshanut. In other words, if you read and translate in a linear fashion, they're the same. El Achicha is your brother, El Esav is Esav. But there's so much, the redundancy is glaring to the degree that for Rashi they actually have a relationship. They're not equivalent to each other, but rather they are the hope versus the reality. So El Achicha is what you would like it to be, but El Esav is what it actually is. That's really something to look out for, because you have words written, you know, black on white, they're stated as facts, but nonetheless they're different tiers of reality. This is Rashi's comment, a chiddush indeed. So Yaakov is afraid, and the Malachim come back with news like that. He's got to do something. Vayira Yaakov ma'od vayetzer lo. Yaakov is afraid, he's troubled, and of course, again, there seems to be a duality within this reaction. He's afraid, he's troubled. What is the difference between Vayira Yaakov and vayetzer lo? Rashi again, of course, comments, as we know, he was afraid that he could be killed, and he was troubled that he may have to kill others. Well, interestingly, as pointed out by the Mefarshim, when he's afraid that he will be killed, it says, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od. When it says, Vayetzelo, he's distressed that he may have to kill others. He is distressed, but he's not distressed Ma'od. Given the circumstance, he's not as distressed that he has to kill them as he is afraid that they will kill him. It's a distressful situation, but his choice is obviously clear. So what does he do? Vayachatz es ha'am asherito. He divides the camp, ves hatzon, v'abakar v'agmalim l'shnei malachos, the whole thing into two camps. Vayomer, and he says as follows. Imavo Esav el ha'achas v'hikahu. If should Esav come to the one camp and smite it, attack it. V'haya ha-machaneh ha-nish'ar lifleita. Then the other camp will escape. Now the simple understanding of what Yaakov has done is that he's divided them into two, and the reasoning is, if Esau attacks one, the other will get away. The question is, why is this considered to be a good strategy? As if to say, does he rate his chances against Esau positively or not? If he feels he has a good chance against Esau, he should actually keep the machaneh together. I mean, the more of them they are, the better. To divide them into two, so one of them is prepared to run away just in case the first one gets defeated, so that's a waste of resources. Unless he feels that he won't be able to defeat Esau. But if that's the case, they should all run away now. Why should one of them present itself to be defeated just so the other one should run away? So we really need to get an insight into what Yaakov felt was the correct course here and why he thought this was the best way to deal with things. Now, from strategy to grammar. The Pasuk says, Pasuk Tes, Im yavo Esav, Esav el ha-machaneh ha-achas ve'iko, if he comes to the first camp and smites it, v'haya ha-machaneh ha-nish'ar lifleita. Now what's striking about this pasuk is that the word machaneh has been used twice, but the first time it is referred to in the feminine form, Im yavo Esav el ha-machaneh ha-achas. But then it says v'haya ha-machaneh ha-nish'ar lifleita. If machaneh is a feminine word, then as surely as it says ha-machaneh ha-achas, it should say v'haysa or v'haya ha-machaneh ha-nish'eres lifleita. But if it's masculine, then it shouldn't be ha-machaneh ha-achas, it should be ha-machaneh ha-echad. So which is it? Is the word machaneh, is it a masculine word or is it a feminine word? And Rashi says, yes. Meaning, the word machaneh, it's one of those words, Rashi's words, machaneh mishamesh lachshon zachar velachshon lekeva. It's one of those words that can be used for either. And there are a few words like that, and Rashi gives another couple of examples. Okay. So, if we find the word machaneh used with the masculine grammar, it's understood, because that can happen. And if we find it in the feminine form, that's also understood, because it can happen. But the question, it seems, persists. Because as much as it could be either, why is it both? Especially within the same pasuk. That seems to be a dafka message from within the pasuk. The pasuk didn't decide policy. For this pasuk, it's going to be used in the feminine or the masculine. And both of them are acceptable, and we find examples of each elsewhere in Tanakh. But it actually shifted halfway, and in fact, it wasn't even between the beginning and the end of the pasuk, between ha-machaneh ha-achas, feminine, versus ha-machaneh ha-nish'ar, masculine. The shift has already taken place within the first half of the pasuk, because it says, im yavo el e'esov el ha-machaneh ha-achas vehikahu. Vehikahu is actually the masculine already. It doesn't say vehikaha or vehiksa or whatever it is. Vehikahu. So it really seems to be very tightly fused, the Loshon Zachar and Loshon Nekeva, and we need to try and find out. And that, in a sense, Rashi's explained that both are acceptable, but he left it for post-Rashi Mefarshim to wonder why it is that you have actually both together in the same pasuk. It's also interesting, if we read carefully, to note that Yaakov's expression is, again in Pasuk Tes, Im yavo Esav el ha-machaneh ha-achas v'hikahu. We often learn a great deal about the way the Pasuk talks by considering how we would summarize or paraphrase the Pasuk in our words and then look back and see exactly whether the Pasuk said that. If we were describing Yaakov's tactics, we would say, if Esav attacks the first camp, the second camp somehow will escape. Yaakov did not say that exactly. He said something more. He says, Im yavo Esav el ha-machaneh ha-achas v'hikahu. If he comes to the first camp and attacks it. Now that entire introductory phrase, Im yavo Esav el ha-machaneh ha-achas, seems also to be superfluous, because he can't attack the camp unless he comes to it. The pasuk should rather perhaps have said more directly, "Im yakeh Esav es hamachane ha'achas." If he strikes the first one, the other one will be lifneta. But he really elongates the scenario. Im yavo Esav el hamachane ha'achas. But him coming to the camp is subsumed with him attacking the camp. And if it isn't, then it's irrelevant. If he attacks it from afar, what difference does it make? And this is a certain, again, two stages that are reiterated as Yaakov offers his tefillah, we find in Pasuk Yud Beis. And he davens at last, it seems. First he gets prepared, and then he davens. Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad Esav, ki yarei anochi oso, pen yavo vihikani eim apanim. I'm afraid lest he come and attack me. Pen yavo vihikani. And not, as we would suggest, the more direct, pen yakeini eim apanim. Okay, so these are questions to keep in mind. And we move on. For as we know, Sheni, Pasuk Yud Dalet, introduces another aspect of the of Yaakov's preparations. Vayikach min haba biyado mincha le'esav achiv. So he gathers together a gift for Esav. And the question is, what's the purpose of this gift? Now, the answer would seem to be quite simple. It's an act of appeasement. It's a conciliatory act. If we would perhaps follow up the question that if Esav wants to kill him, then this is hardly a deterrent. Because if Esav feels that he'll destroy him, he'll get this gift plus all the remainder and still kill Yaakov. So it's hardly two options. He can either have everything, including killing Yaakov, or some of it and leave Yaakov alive. Why is that considered to be a positive option? Perhaps that's not a question. Perhaps the gesture alone would appease Esav and would soften his approach towards Yaakov. Perhaps. What's very interesting after having expressed some of the questions of these regarding this opening psukim is to consider the words of the Rashbam. Back in Pasuk Zion, where the messengers come back and they say, Banu el achicha el Esav. We've seen Rashi's Perush. Rashi says, it's bad news. You thought he was your brother, but he's not. He's Esav. Be prepared. And Yaakov gets prepared. The Rashbam says, Banu el achicha el Esav. We came to Esav. Umatzasa chein be'enav. Ka'asher amarta. And it worked. You said, Vo'esh lecha lagid l'adoni, I'm sending a delegation limtso chein be'enecha to find favor in your eyes. We came. And it worked. He's in a good mood. V'gam hine, and moreover, mitoch she yismach b'viyascha, uva'avaso oscha, holech likroscha. Out of joy and out of love, he's coming to meet you. V'abamios ishimo l'chvodcho. He's bringing 400 men for Kabbalah's panim. He's coming to say hello in the best possible way. Zehu ikar pshuto. That is the primary, simple, straightforward understanding of the words. Now, of course, I'm not sure where's the greater chiddush in the words of the Rashbam. His explanation, or those final three words, Zehu Ikar Pshuto. Because when he says that's the main pshat, he is well aware that higher up the page, his grandfather Rashi has actually explained the pasuk not that way. Rashi has said, you thought he was your brother. No, he's really Esav. You are in trouble. Rashbam says, the Ikar Pshat is that he's happy with you, and he's coming to meet you. And he wants to make friends again. So the Rashbam, and this is not the first time it happens, nor is there anything wrong with this. No one knows Rashi better than the Rashbam, but he will take issue on Rashi in pshat terms when he feels necessary. And therefore, he's seen Rashi who explained this in a negative way, but the Rashbam says, in my understanding, it's positive. And what's interesting is, it seems, I think the Rashbam means to address this. There's a word, which again, if we gloss over it, we miss it. But they come back and they say, Banu elachicha el Esav. Okay, we came. Vegam holech likrascha ba'abamios isha ima. The word vegam is the most easily ignored word in that pasuk. And again, in our words, we'd say, we came to him, and he's actually coming to meet you. But they didn't say, and he's coming. They said, and also he's coming. But vegam is difficult, because if vegam means also, you can't say the word also if it's introducing the first piece of news. We came to Esav. What's happening? One thing. He's also coming to meet you. You can't start number one on the list with also. So what is the meaning of the word vegam? It must be that vegam holech likrascha is actually number two. Which means number one is what they said first. Banu elachicha el Esav. That's the first piece of news. Meaning, you sent a delegation to Esav to find favor in his eyes. And number one, that worked. Vegam, and moreover, right, in addition to that, he's coming to meet you. Rabameos ish imo. So that's a further piece of news. And interestingly, the Rashbam concludes, V'chein gam hine hu yotze lekroscha v'roacha v'somach bilibo. That's a quotation from the beginning of Sefer Shemos, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe at the burning bush, Aaron is coming out to meet you. Hine olech lekroscha v'roacha v'somach bilibo. What does the Rashbam mean to indicate by quoting this pasuk? I think his intention is clear. That you see the notion of Yotze Likroscha has a positive connotation. In the same way that Aaron was called Yotze Likros Moshe, and of course it was only positive, Baroacha, V'samach B'libo, that tells you that this phrase of Yotze Likroso means in a positive way, he's coming out to meet you towards a good end. And if that's what it means in Sefer Shemos, says Rashbam, then in our pasuk when it says Vegam holech likrosecha, that also means it has a positive connotation. And that's what I'm saying, says Rashbam. As far as Rashi is concerned, presumably the word Yotze likrosecha is neutral. It's a blank page. It just means it's just about direction. It's not about intention. Yotze likrosecha means geographically he's coming to meet you. What's his intention? Could be for war, could be for peace. It's non-denominational. And in this case, it's negative. But interestingly, the Rashbam sees in the very phrase Yotze Likroscha a positive connotation. And therefore, that's really bears out the positive coloring that he sees within this pasuk. So for the Ma'ase Hashem, the Ma'ase Hashem adds, and he really takes over from the Rashbam at this point, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, Elachicha El Esav do not represent, as Rashi says, the reality hoped for and the reality you ended up getting. But rather, Elachich al Esav, it's all there. He is your brother Esav. Exactly as you hoped it, that's who we found. And he's coming. So this is interesting. So far we have a major, I think, machlokus rishonim as to how to understand the message that's coming back from Esav. There's just one problem. Why does Yaakov react with fear? In other words, according to Rashi, they said, he's coming to war. So Yaakov is afraid. And there's a whole literature as to why he should be afraid. Didn't Hashem promise him he'd look after him? That's the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Dalet and the Rambam and the Shmona Prokim. Okay, but you understand why once you answer all those questions, he was afraid because someone's coming with 400 people to try and kill him. But for the Rashbam, that the answer was overwhelmingly positive. He's delighted. He's coming to see you. He's going to make a kiddush for you. So what's Yaakov afraid of? The kashrus? Vayirav Yaakov Ma'od. He's very afraid. Vayetzalo, and he's distressed. What's distressed about? They came back with a fantastic answer. Says the Ma'ase Hashem. Yaakov is afraid for a simple reason. Positive response from Esav could be even worse than a negative response. For a simple reason. He may be lying. I mean, here's Esav. And he's had a lot of time to think about this. Which means that there are two possibilities. If you hear a report that he wants to make peace with you and he's coming to meet you, there are two ways it will play out. Either he's telling the truth, which is a possibility, in which case, fantastic. Alternatively, he could be lying. In which case, he may catch you off guard. Because he sent a message of peace, but that means you're expecting peace when he comes for war. Not for the last time. And therefore, Yaakov was very afraid. Because he's not sure whether he can trust Esav. But there's more to it than that. Not only is he afraid that maybe Esav is lying, he's also distressed. And the reason why he's distressed is because since Esav officially is coming in peace, Yaakov is not able to prepare himself for war as fully as he would like to. Because ostensibly, Esav is coming for peaceful purposes. And that is why we say that from a certain point of view, it would have been better for Esav to say he's coming for war. Because if it's official, I can be prepared. But if it's officially peace, but possibly war, I'm in a weaker position. Because I can't even prepare adequately. There's always the possibility, number one, that it really is for peace. And if I show up in full battle dress, ready for war, then I'm the Rasha. Because he came in peace and I met him with war. I couldn't take a chance. That's one possibility. And therefore, the second point is I'm going to have to show him a peaceful face and perhaps even invite him into my camp. Because officially, we're friends. I don't even have the luxury of protecting my borders. Because why would I keep him out if he's coming for peace? So he could actually have the easiest entry into my camp just under the guise of peace. And that's more distressing than anything else. Because I can't even defend myself. And maybe he is coming for war. This is the second point. Maybe he is coming for war, but he wants me to be the one that started the war. So I will be the criminal. And he will have all the trappings of a peaceful delegation. But we both know he's coming for war. So if I react in a warlike way, I'll be the one that started it. I mean, this sounds very familiar. And that really, number one, is the duality of Vayira Yaakov Ma'od. Yaakov is afraid. Vayetzelo, but in addition to the fear, he's distressed that he's his hands are tied, even to defend himself. And that is why he expresses his fear as Im Yavo Esav. That's the fear. The fear is not that he'd strike me. If that was my only fear, I could hopefully defend myself before he strikes me or react to him. The fear is not just pen yakeni, in other words, it's a two-stage process. He'll come right to my front door and I have to invite him in. And then he'll strike me. And what chance do I have? Well, what's the response now? It says, the Ma'asi Hashem, Yaakov divides his camp into two. And what's behind dividing his camp into two? The one camp, the one that will greet Esav initially, they can't be armed to the teeth. They can't be decked out for war. They've got to be a camp of peace, because there is a possibility that Esav really wants peace. However, Yaakov is aware that it could turn ugly very quickly. To that end, there's another camp. And that other camp, which is not part of the original receiving camp, but they are ready. They're ready to be activated at a moment's notice in order to rush to the scene should it turn sour. And this is actually a very different understanding of what Yaakov means when he says, the first camp is attacked, the second camp will be there, lifleta. Lifleta is for to be saved, right, for saving, we normally understand that in what way will it be for saving? It will run away and it will escape. Lifleta. But there are Rishonim who explain that lifleta doesn't mean saving themselves by running away. It means saving the first camp that's being attacked. They're there ready to assist if necessary. They just can't be the first thing. It can't be the camp that greets Esau because it's not a camp of peace, it's a camp of war. So that's the situation. This brings us to the usage of the masculine and the feminine form when it comes to the machane. We find throughout Chumash that things which are milder and softer are referred to in the feminine form. Kotomar lebeis Yaakov. Beis Yaakov, Rashi says, Eilu hanoshim, that's the women. Some say it refers to just people who are of a milder demeanor. And there you have Amira. Amira Raka, that's the nicer way of talking. For Yisrael, v'tageid koshim kegidim. And certainly when it comes to war, certainly in that time, we understand that I think this is really what's being communicated between the usage of the feminine versus the masculine form for the camps. Because the question is it a camp of peace or is it a camp of war? That's what is being communicated. This is not to take away from any women who are capable of killing, but as a characterization. Yaakov says, "Im yavo Esav el hamachane ha'achas." He divided his camps into two, and the first one is called hamachane ha'achas in the feminine. Why? Because it's a camp of peace. He has to greet Esav with a camp of peace. What's the worry? The worry is he'll approach that camp. V'hikahu. What's happened? The feminine has turned into the masculine. Why? Because the peaceful camp may turn into a war scene. He may attack. If he does, if he will relate to that machane ha'achas as a vehikahu, so then there's another camp, machane ha'nishar, which is actually ready for war. Again, you have the Loshon Zohar. So I believe this is what is behind that shift. It's happened so quickly. Within the very same pasuk, it seems, right? It's so striking. Because it represents the different characterizations of these two camps that Yaakov has ready for Esav. So Yaakov is prepared, and now he waits, because he doesn't know what Esav is thinking. The question is there any way to find out? I mean, he's already sent a delegation. He got back a positive answer, which is either the hoped-for truth or a terrible lie. So he can't ask again. Is there any way he can test the veracity of Esav's positive intentions? I think the answer is yes. That is what he's doing by sending the gift to Esav. Specifically, in the way that he does. Because what's most interesting and most noteworthy, noticeable, about the gift that he sends to Esav, as we see in Pasuk Yud Zayin, is that it's such a spread out process. He tells them, he takes all of these animals, and if they're all sent together, the whole thing can be over and done with in about 5 minutes. But he doesn't do it that way. He gives them one flock, each one by itself. Vayomer el avadav, ivru lefanai, pass before me, verevach tasimu, and place a good amount of distance, bein eder uvein eder, between each flock. Why does he say to place a good amount of distance? So again, Rashi says that in order that it looks so expansive, that's it's good advertising. But we find that not only does he really spread them out in that way so that it looks impressive, but in Pasuk Yud Ches, he gives them instructions as to what to say. Vayitzav esarishon leimor, the first group, he says, Ki yifgashcha Esav achi. When Esav meets you, u'she'elcha leimor, and asks you, Lemi ata, v'onetelech, who are you? Who do you belong to? Where are you going? U'lemi eile lefanecha. V'amartel avtecha leYaakov, you'll say, we belong to Yaakov. Mincha yishalucha laduni leEsav, this is a gift for Esav. V'hinei gam hu acharenu, and he's behind us. Behold, he's behind us. Apparently the message is that Yaakov is right behind us. But the point is, there's a number of flocks this way. It's a number of herds. And he keeps on saying this to them. Pasuk Kaf. Vayitzav, Gamas Hasheni. Gamas Hashlishi. Gamas Kol HaHolchem Acharei HaAdarim Neimor. Which means that each group, as it meets Esav, and Esav will say, well, who are you? They say, we belong to Yaakov. And he's coming soon. But this happens a few times. Which means Yaakov's arrival is announced a number of times before he comes. What is the point of all of this? I believe, in addition to the appeasement factor, the reason why it's spread out this way is in order to raise the tension of the expectation of Esav seeing Yaakov. That is to say, if Esav's intentions are positive, as we know, when you're looking forward to see someone, and you think, well, he's almost here, he's coming soon, wait, just a little bit, another few moments. So as the tension mounts, so one's expectation is only positive. But if you're looking to kill them, and they keep on being announced, and they never turn up, and then tension rises, at a certain point, you snap. In other words, what Yaakov is looking to do by announcing his arrival 4 or 5 times before he's there is to see whether by the time he gets to Esav, Esav will have been just, his delight will have been mounting steadily, or his proposed facade of delight will have eroded completely. That is the process, the drawn-out process of sending him the mincha. And what's interesting is, he says in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, the Amartim, Gam Hine Abdecha Yaakov Acharenu. Tell you know Yaakov is by Ki Amar, for Yaakov said, Achaprafonov. That's an interesting expression. Achaprafonov comes from the word kapara. What does it mean? Well, the simple understanding is how would we translate it? I will atone his face. It means that I will make up with him. Achaprafonov. Ba mincha haolechas lefanai. I'm gonna use the mincha that goes before me as a lechaper fanav, the acharein chen erev fanav, and then I will see his face, ulai yusafanai, maybe he'll be favorable to me. What is this concept of achapra fanav? I will atone for his face. Clearly we need to fine-tune it to in an aspect of appeasement. But actually the word lechaper means something else, and Rashi quotes this here. Lechaper means to wipe something away. And in fact, that's why it's used as atonement, because when an aveira, when a sin is wiped, is atoned for, it's wiped away. But it's the physical act of wiping something away from the surface is called kapara. That's why the Tanakh elsewhere refers to the kelim in the Beis HaMikdash as kipurim. Kipurim because they would wipe their fingers on the rim, right, to clear them of the blood on the surface of their hands. That's called lechaper, to wipe something away from the surface. I think based on the approach of the Masi Hashem, we may suggest that here Yaakov is expressing, Achaprafanov, why am I giving this milk in this? Why am I winding him up for over an hour? Because I need to wipe away whatever's on the surface of his face to find out what's underneath. Ki amar Achaprafanov, he may have a facade. This may be a front. I've got to get rid of that. And I will do that through the agency of Bamincha Holeches Lefanai, the Acharechein Erefonav, and then I'll see his face. I've got to wipe it in order to see it, because I've got to see his true face. And maybe he really is genuine. I will know from how he receives the Mincha. So this really is, I believe, a great deal of new insight into the preparations for the meeting with Yaakov. And the truth is, again, if we follow the Fipshuto, certainly the Derech of the Rashbam and others, it's one for the books, but Esav really did have positive feelings on this occasion, and it was a positive meeting, and part of what was most positive about it, as far as Yaakov is concerned, is they never saw each other again. But for its time, it ended peacefully, which was what Yaakov was hoping for. So these are some observations with regards to the beginning of the Parsha through the Maaseh Hashem. And let's move from there to the twin episode at the beginning of Vayishlach, which is the fight between Yaakov and the Malach here. And that's mentioned in Pasuk Kafhei, Perek Lamed Beis Pasuk Kafhei. By Yivasa Yaakov Levado, the well-known Pasuk, of course, by Ovekish Imo, Adalos HaShachar. So he's there by himself, someone's struggling with him until the morning, etc., and so forth. If we didn't know the background, or if we didn't have any additional information, this Pasuk would be obscure in the extreme. If we had no sense of Masora, or we didn't know who is this Ish and what are they fighting about, just to read the Pasuk, he's there by himself, and someone's fighting with him. What are they fighting about? Doesn't say. Just says they fought the whole night. So there is no question that we need access to the Masora here. Otherwise, this Pasuk it's a closed book. But the Pasuk doesn't say what they were fighting about. There's only one thing we do know, which may or may not help us, and that the Pasuk says again, Vayivoso Yaakov Levado, Yaakov was there by himself. What's he doing there by himself? He just got stranded somehow. Well, Rashi comments, it's from the Medrash, he went back for Pachim Ketanim. He forgot those small pots or jugs, so he went back for them. He went back by himself, and thus he was alone. So it's very interesting, because it turns out that and again, if Rashi comments, that means it's somehow alluded to in the Pasuk, by Yivasa Yaakov Levado. It turns out that the only signal we get from the Pasuk, the only message as to the background to this struggle, is how Yaakov came to be alone. He went back for the Pachim Ketanim. As soon as we know that, he's already fighting. But how does this become a key piece of information? I mean, it's just that sequentially it's the background, but how does it form any of the conceptual background? Now the Pasuk says, of course, Vayeovik Ish Ima, we translate someone struggled with him, wrestled with him, but the word Vayeovik, we've taken a liberty of translating in that way. The word Vayeovik relates or derives from the word avak, which is dust. And again, Rashi comments and all Mefarshim comment, why is it that the word avak somehow becomes a key word here? It becomes turned into a verb, because the literal translation of Vayeovik Ish Ima is that someone dusted with him. But practically it means someone struggled with him. But how does the word avak become the way that's communicated? And the Gemara in Maseches Chulin, Daf Tzadik Aleph Amud Beis, comments further about this dust. It's very significant now, which is almost a contradiction in terms. But Vayeovik, this says the Gemara, Melamed Sheheelu Avak Baraglehem Ad Kisei Akovod. They raised the dust as they stomped around or until the Kisei Akovod. Now that's clearly a mashal. I mean, there's no way physically that dust could reach the Kisei Akovod, especially as the Kisei Akovod itself is a spiritual thing. So there's no vector of direction. So then these words of Chazal also needs to be understood. Divrei Chachamim v'chidosam. What is the meaning of raising this dust until the Kisei Akovod? We find that as the fight continues, Yaakov holds firm and he can't be toppled. But Vayarki lo yocholo, says Pasuk Kaf Vav, Vayiga b'chaf yirecho. So he knocked him in the thigh, take a kaf yirech Yaakov, and it got dislocated. And that translates into the Isser of the Gid Hanoshe. So Pasuk says, Alkein lo yocholo b'nei Yisrael es Gid Hanoshe. And although for us we never go anywhere near the Gid Hanoshe, so in our experience it's just not there by the time we buy any meat. But it's just fascinating to consider that this episode became translated into one of the 613 mitzvahs. I mean, many things happen to the Avos, some positive, some difficult, but as a result of that, there is one of the 365 negative prohibitions is to eat the Gid Hanoshe because Yaakov had this fight with the Malach. Somehow it became part of the code of Torah. There's a famous comment of the Zohar HaKadosh, which draws a parallel between the 365 Gidin and the 365 days of the year, of the solar year, that is. And, of course, it's difficult. The Gidin are the sinews, difficult to know exactly which sinew is for which day, But one of them we know, says the Zohar HaKadosh, Tisha B'Av corresponds to the Gid HaMoshe. And of course, we can in a general way understand that Tisha B'Av is a very negative day and Gid HaMoshe is something that we can't eat, but we might be looking to understand a bit more as to what the connection between them is. The key, according to some Mefarshim, is expressed respectively between Esav and Yaakov, the way that they relate to their possessions. In Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Tes. So Yaakov and Esav, they've met, and it's all friendly. And then Esav wishes to decline the gift. He says in Pasuk Tes, Vayom Esav, Yesh li Rav, I have so much, so you can keep yours, Achi Yilacha Shelach. But Yaakov persists. Yaakov insists, and says, "No, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Kach Nois Birchasiya Shehu Vaslach, Ki Chanani Elokim Chiyesh Li Kol, because Hashem has been kind to me. Hashem has given me everything." So it's very interesting. Just within the space of these two or three psukim, Esav says Yesh Li Rav, and Yaakov says Yesh Li Kol. This finds its way into the benching. Bakol Mi Kol Kol. The Kol is the Kol of Hakol Kol Yaakov, if you know what I mean. The word kol in that phrase comes from Yaakov, ki yesh li kol. Says Rashi, on the word yesh li kol, but Yaakov says, I have everything? That's a lot. I have everything? Kol sipuki, I have everything I need. A person who has everything he needs really has everything, because he's not missing anything. The Esav dibe b'loshen gava, but Esav spoke in a much more expansive way, in a gaivadika way. Yesh li rav. Yosef v'yosef mikadei tzorchi. I have a lot of things. That's the closest he could come to a self-characterization. I have lots of things. More than I could ever use or need. But I still have it. And these now become two hashkofas, really. What would a person say about themselves? I have everything I need, or I have lots of things. More than I need, but it's still, I have a lot of things. So to understand a bit of the root of these two perspectives and why they will become the war ultimately between Yaakov and Esav for all generations. We find, interestingly, Esav has a certain set of garments that are referred to in Parshas Toldos that are apparently very significant. When just before Rivka sends Yaakov in to get the bracha, so she takes Big Day Esav HaChamudos, these desired garments that Esav had, and Esav kept them with her because he didn't trust his wives, and she gave them to Yaakov. And that's very significant. Somehow that's important as a prelude to Yaakov getting the bracha to have these Big Day Chamudos. Essentially, it relates to the divide between Yitzhak and Rivka as to who should receive the brachos. Yitzhak feels that Esav should receive the brachos, but Rivka says no, under no circumstances, it's got to be Yaakov. And what's behind that? And as a prelude to her move for Yaakov to get the brachos, she gives him Esav's clothes. What does this mean? So Maharal explains that ultimately the significance of these clothes is about the question of external expression versus internal merit. These clothes originally belonged to Adam HaRishon. I mean that's the Medrash tells us, that from Adam HaRishon then to Nimrod then to Esav. Adam HaRishon was the one who originally wore these special clothes. He, Adam HaRishon, is the original Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, in keeping with the level of Adam, and again, there's much to discuss about Adam HaRishon in terms of Parshas Bereishis, but he was made directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even after his sin, he is Adam HaRishon. And therefore, it was fitting for him to have these special clothes because as a special person, essentially, it is appropriate to have a special expression of that person. That's the understanding of these clothes of Adam HaRishon. Clothing doesn't make the man, but clothing does give cover to a person. And the Gemara tells us famously, as we go in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, that Rabbi Yochanan, he would refer to his clothing as mechabdusi, those that give me honor. And indeed, halachas are learned from this. There's a halacha that one should wear special clothes for Shabbos. That's a halacha. Where does it come from? The pasuk states in Yeshaya, v'chibadato mi'asos drachecha. V'chibadato, to honor the Shabbos, but v'chibadato, says the Gemara, means to wear special clothes. And invokes Rabbi Yochanan's comment. Rabbi Yochanan used to call his clothes mechabdusi. So v'chibadato means to wear special mechabdim, big day Shabbos. Now, when Adam HaRishon passed away, so these clothes fell into the wrong hand, but they made their way back to the family of the Avos. Now, Avram, really what the Avos are doing is they're looking to reclaim to the degree possible the original level of Adam HaRishon. It's a trail back to the Madrega of Adam HaRishon. Begins with Avram and then passed on to Yitzchak. When it comes to Yitzchak, so Yitzchak splits into two. And we notice that the Yaakov and Esav, I mean, they are twins. They're not as separate as Yitzchak and Yishmael. Yishmael was completely sidelined from the program. Yaakov and Esav, they are twins. Born of the same father, carried by the same mother. Of course, they're very different. But it could be that what until now Avram and Yitzchak could carry as individuals, Yaakov and Esav will carry as a team. And as surely therefore as Yaakov is Ishtam, Yosheva Halim, he stays inside and he's developing himself and he's in Yeshiva Shem Ve'ever. Esav is Ish Sodeh, and maybe that's where he should be. Because that could be a positive thing. It could be that Esav is going out and representing the family of Yitzchak in the broader world. To that degree, Esav is the one that got the clothes of Adam HaRishon. He's the one that got the big day chamudis, because he's the one that will represent the family on the outside, and therefore this external representation of Tzelem Elokim, one could almost say that Yaakov got the Tzelem Elokim, and Esav represents him with the big day chamudos. So essentially it's about Esav's connection with Yaakov. They are two people who are carrying on the task of Adam HaRishon himself. That's if Esav had risen to the occasion. The problem is, he didn't do that. And here's the rift, or the difference of vision between Yitzchak and Rivka. Yitzchak sees that Esav is fulfilling his task. And that's why he wishes to give him the brachas of physical bounty, which is success in this world, in order to promote, in terms of this world, the legacy of the Avos, of Avram and of Yitzchak. Rivka understands that Esav is already, not only is he not living up to the clothing, but rather they're no longer a depiction or a reflection of a certain level of Tzelem Elokim. They've actually become a substitution for it. And the focus now becomes on how he projects himself. Esav is the famous Chazir. He's the one that the lower he gets, the more he sticks his hooves out, because the hooves of the pig are kosher. And the more they're pushed forwards, the lower he goes. And at this point, Esav has failed. He's failed to live up to, and this now becomes his legacy. Because he will now invest exclusively in how holy he looks, at the expense, almost now by definition, of how kosher he actually is. And therefore Rivka understands that the brachas can't be given to Esav. He will not use them, he will abuse them. And at Yaakov's expense, they will not be used to further the cause of Yaakov. They'll be used to persecute Yaakov. And therefore, in keeping with Rivka's judgment that Yaakov now needs to take on all aspects of the future of the Jewish people, so in sending him in to receive the brachas of bounty in this world, she takes Esav's clothes that originally belonged to Yaakov and to Adam HaRishon, and to put them onto Yaakov. In other words, Yaakov now has to represent the whole thing by himself. And Esav now remains with this way of approaching things. It's about self-promotion and self-expression and no longer about self-development. And this is the point where Aesop begins to lay great emphasis on acquiring things, because it's because he now defines himself no longer by what he is, which is very little, but by what he has. And that's the most external way of a person expressing themselves, by the more possessions they have, the more everything they have. And that's really what's behind Esav versus Yaakov. Esav is actually Rav. That's the most he can say about himself. Who am I? I have a lot of things. That's me. When Yaakov says actually Kol, that's a statement about him as a person. I'm happy with what I have. That's a madriga. Esav has no madriga, and therefore all of his qualities can only be expressed as quantities. It's interesting, the Maharal says in the end of his third introduction to the Sefer Gevuras Hashem that we find there's a term that's used very closely together with Esav. It's at the end of Parshas Vayishlach. All of his leaders, his great men, are called alufim. Lahavdil, not to disparage anyone who's called an aluf, Lahavdil ben Kodesh Lachol, but aluf comes from the word elef. And in a sense, that the distinction of the person is that he has 1,000 men under him. In other words, the only way that you can define him as a person is by how many other people there are who heed his command. So if his madrega is phrased as a number, as a quantity, that's the only way that Esav can think. And at this point, the bounty of this world, whereas the bracha of Yitzhak, it was only ever used to be a tool, a stepping stone, for a kelim, for something higher. But for Esav at this point, there is nothing higher. There is no self-improvement. So amassing these things and acquiring these things becomes the ultimate goal in itself. The means have become the end. And let us now, acharei hadvarim ha'ele, come back to Yaakov as he's alone. Yaakov, he went back. He went back for Pachim Ketan. Why would he go back for Pachim Ketan? In other words, they seem to be rather inconsequential. Why are they important? Well, the Arizal explains that Yaakov has such a highly developed sense of Hashkocha that it's clear to him that if he owns them, they must have some use, and therefore he's not just going to neglect them. That would be ownership per se. But if there's some tachlis, so who knows when he may need them for some aspect of Jewish living, so he goes back. Which means to go back for these Pachim Ketanim is a statement of Yaakov's sense of purpose, of higher purpose. However, that is an attitude that needs preserving, that needs safeguarding. Because there's just a very thin line between paying so much attention and having so much emphasis on physical items as a means to an end, one's very close to that the end will become the means. And in fact, at this point that Yaakov goes back for these possessions, enter Sorashel Esav. Because Sorashel Esav represents another approach that would go back for the very same possessions for the entirely antithetical reason, because it sees in possessions per se the ultimate pursuit. And you have the strangest journey back for these Pachim Ketanim, because two people whose worldview is entirely at odds with each other's are actually heading in the same direction. They're both going back for the same thing. But the critical question is why? I believe, Ramban actually comments that when the pasuk says "Vayavik ish imo," Ramban connects the word "Vayavik" to the word "Lechabek," which is to embrace. Because when people wrestle, they embrace. But what's interesting is when people wrestle, it's very difficult to know when one person ends and the other person starts. They become like one being with four arms and four legs with two heads. "Vayavik ish imo," and that's the problem. The problem is it's very difficult for a person to preserve their sense of distinction from the other way of approaching these things. And thus it emerges that when Chazal tell us that Yaakov went back for Pachim Ketanim, and then all of a sudden he's fighting, we've been told all we need to know. Because the fight is about the Pachim Ketanim. Why are you going back for those things? Why do you want to own things? Why is that important to you? And if the answer is because they're things, and you see inherent value in ownership, that's the struggle. Because that represents an investment per se in the bounty of Olam Hazeh. Avak, dust, depicts this very accurately, because as its own entity, it's essentially worthless. You talk about dust, it's nothing. But of course, dust, enough of it can be useful. Right? I mean, bricks can be made of it. Things can be made of it. So in terms of what it's worth very little. In terms of what it can do to a higher goal, it can have use. And thus we find the notion of avak, also in halacha, represents something which is secondary, of secondary status. Avak ribis, or avak loshen hara. It's the dust of those things, in the sense that it's not the thing itself. And therefore, when the struggle between Yaakov and Sarashel Esav, it's called vayeovik ishimo, they're dusting. In the sense that it's a question of Yaakov's perspective on matters of Olam Hazeh. Are they dust? That is to say, they're useful for what they can do, but of no outstanding ultimate value for what they are? Or no? Are they the ultimate goal? That's the struggle. And it lasts the whole night. And that is why the Gemara says, Helu avakad lekisi hakovod. That's really what it's about. In other words, the kisi hakovod represents ultimate level, ultimate purpose. These things, are they of an equivalent importance, equivalent significance? As far as Sarashel Esav is concerned, this is it. This is his kisi hakovod. It's dust. Where Yaakov has to fight to keep the dust down. It's got to be kept in its place. Well, who won? Sarashel Esav did not prevail, but he did score a knock against Yaakov, the Bekaf HaYorech. And Kaf HaYorech, which is close to the reproduction, that refers to future generations of the Jewish people. Yaakov as a person stays firm on this issue. But in the fullness of time, there exists the danger and the propensity within some of his descendants to overindulge in Olam Hazeh, in self-promotion and in external self-expression as the ultimate goal. And the way that it found its most tragic expression was in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which was brought about through Sinas Chinam. Sinas Chinam is a great mystery for us, because it's something that happened for no reason, apparently. But things don't happen for no reason. Sinas Chinam, of course, doesn't mean for no reason. It means for no good reason. But in the eye of the hater, he has good reason. Who falls prey to Sinas Chinam? Someone whose life goal is that of self-promotion. Because there's rarely enough room in the world for more than one like him. And therefore he's instantly suspicious and has very malignant vision about anyone who he perceives as looking to steal his thunder. And therefore, Sinas Chinam, someone who is Ishtam Yoshev Aholim, there's room for everyone. But there can't be too many Esavs around. There can't be too many Bigdei Chamudos around. And therefore, the tragic fallout of those of Yaakov's descendants who did fall prey to the knock of Sarashel Esav, which expressed itself in Sinas Chinam, because there's only a finite number of possessions and I need to have them, and the other one shouldn't have them. No one sameach bechelko. Everyone's threatened by everyone else. The result was Tisha B'Av. And that's why the Zohar Kodesh says that the Gid HaNoshe, which is the reminder of this struggle, corresponds to the day of Tisha B'Av, because the victory that was scored through the Gid HaNoshe expressed itself ultimately in the day of Tisha B'Av. It's important for us to realize this, because the Pasuk says they struggled all night. Adalos HaShachar. The Rashba says in his Chedush HaGodos, in Maseches Chulin, their Daf Tzadik Aleph, the night, of course, is Golos. And Yaakov, he is the father of Golos. When it says they struggled the whole night, that means this is a struggle that continues for all of Golos. Because as long as we are hosted by those nations, and even if we're back here, but influenced by those nations, It's a struggle that continues. How do we relate to success in Olam Hazeh, possessions of Olam Hazeh? We're embraced with the nations of the world, but we need to preserve our distinction. And if we consider the negative consequences, the tragic consequences of our over-investing in matters of this world, success in this world, as an end in itself, which led to Tisha B'Av and led to the Kitah Nasha, that's why the Torah codifies it as an Isser. It's a reminder. This is a tool for us to help us throughout our history to remember that that was really the victory of Sar Shel Esav in order to keep us on track, to make sure that all the things that we value, down to the Pachim Ketanim, but we continue to relate to them as dust, to keep them in proper perspective and use them for their ultimate purpose. And that's a perspective that the more we reaffirm, the more we take our way back, see our way back, Mirat Hashem, to the Dawn, to the Geula, which will come b'meher b'yameinu.